Nomini, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Felix. I would like to say that I live and work on the lands of the Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation. I'm in Naam in Melbourne. Thank you for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure. Now, before we move on to the rest of the interview, is that something you think that people should be considering when they are dealing with where they live? Should people be regularly acknowledging Indigenous owners? Or is this, you know, because it kind of seems like a bit of an inconvenience to some people, right? Is that an effective way to start breaking down that internalized convenience?
Yes, I think it is. And I was having this very discussion with some colleagues today that we've got into this habit of making a symbolic recognition and acknowledgement. What it really means is to delve deeper and to actually make that meaningful for you. What does it actually mean that you're living on colonized land? Like, I'm a Sri Lankan migrant settler here. And when I have reflected on that and really worked through that, you just see that you're getting the benefit that a lot of Indigenous people don't get in this land. So you're also complicit. There is no innocent position here. We are all complicit in the colonial state that has disenfranchised Aboriginal people and then from then on created numerous other hierarchies of otherness as you go along. So it cannot be just an empty symbolic, you know, recognition. I think we need to personalize it and to really reflect on what it means to be a settler on this land.
Yeah.
That's a really important start. Yeah.
So you're touching on there the difference between being non-racist and anti-racist a bit, I suppose, being active in your efforts to counter these systems that have been oppressive to BIPOC, Black, Indigenous people, and people of color. So could you break down the difference between those two stances a little bit, between being non-racist and anti-racist?
Absolutely, and I think before you can talk about racism, you need to understand what race is. And critical race theory, which is what, you know, a lot of myself and my colleagues follow, is to understand the processes and the practices behind what causes racism. And very few of us understand that. So we need to actually understand what race is. To start with, we need to be able to talk about it and understand the structures that hold it up, then to unpack how am I complicit in that? Am I contributing to that? So if you, it's not enough. Anti-racism is not about being a nice person. It's not about being saying, I hate racism. If you don't actually do something beyond recognizing it and take action, you are therefore, as you said at the very start of the quote that you said, we're actually complicit in it. We're upholding those systems. You know, so anti-racism, we need to first understand what it is in this colonial context, how it's embedded in structures and institutions, and how we then, are we actively dismantling or are we simply repeating what has been said about, I mean, we're talking about racialized bodies and places and structures. So if we don't contest it actively, we are actually complicit in it and we're upholding white supremacy.
Yeah.
And that to me is anti-racism, is actually having to work constantly at dismantling the structures that uphold racism.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues that I see a lot personally is when we look at people saying, you know, I'm not racist because I do this or I hold this opinion. You know, for example, America's Declaration of Independence has that all men are created equal in it, when clearly the country has not exactly embodied that over the course of history. How is it possible that people can be both racist and present themselves as anti-racist? And how can we recognize that hypocrisy and tackle it without making enemies of the people around us?
Okay, so you're talking about tackling. First of all, we need to understand that it's an illusion that we've bought into. So, and we need to really unpack what it means to be to say something, like the rhetoric, the actual saying of something, and actually the doing of something. Okay, so just to say you're anti-racist doesn't mean that you're doing anti-racist work. And what a lot of the work, okay, I'll just talk a little bit about, we commonly, popularly now in anti-racist discourse, we're talking a lot about white fragility, white entitlement, we're locating our privilege. That's actually not enough, because that re-centers the whiteness. And you'll find a lot of, you know, anti-racist spaces that white people will probably just think that, you know, once they've learned a little bit about it, that it's okay to run the whole show. Actually, they need to step aside. They need to create spaces and platforms for people of color and Indigenous people to speak and to tell them they're the best ones to be able to guide this process. Because whiteness is something that just recenters all kinds of anti-racism. And that's a very important thing. And the way we understand it is also important. If we can, you know, it's not enough to just point out your privilege. You need to know what you can do with your privilege, how you can share it without taking over the movement.
So with the situation unfolding in Melbourne regarding public housing on lockdown and the heavy police presence, how can we be anti-racist advocates to help the marginalized communities living in those towers without also undermining the safety of the community because of the importance of appreciating the risk of the virus?
Okay, that's a really good one, because there we have to start talking about what discourse we're listening to. So at the moment, the way the government is talking about it has created a huge moral panic by the actions it's taken. These are people that need to be policed into behaving well. You know, when actually when you see that the 80% of the population of those housing estates are people of colour that come from different backgrounds, and they are heavily over-policed anyway. And to come in with a police response when what's really needed is a health response automatically gives a lot of people, maybe who don't have the same racial literacy that maybe I do or you do, it allows them to make that connection that these are people that need to be policed and that it's a criminal act. So the discourse, how they've talked about it, is actually making a moral panic. And it's re-inscribing those bodies with some sort of deficit. And so even I have like Sri Lankan friends who have kind of taken the point that we need to, yes, this is to protect the community. What I think being an anti-racist right now is to go deep into how you should be feeling. A lot of people are feeling shock, horror, grief, disgusted. We're outraged at it. That is the right feeling to be feeling. We need to go into that and understand and ask questions. And that is what I would say being an anti-racist, not jumping in and doing charity help, right? Because people are, the people in those communities are well able to handle this. In fact, they've done a lot of the work themselves. And so we need to be asking, why is this not being treated as a health concern? You know, why have communities who know what they're doing been disempowered by the charities who are coming in and doing actually not a great job? How to read this situation is a form of literacy. You know, how easily are we repeating the stereotypes by saying, how can we help them? In fact, we need to unlearn all this stuff ourselves. And then it's a teachable moment, I think, and I think we need to really use it well. And for me, the intervention in the council flats is playbook, colonial playbook 101. Yeah. A land-based intervention is already earmarked for development in the first place. They've deliberately not kept the building. The government has known that this is actually a high vulnerable population who have been made vulnerable.
Yeah.
So the community themselves have been asking for, you know, cleaning and asking for repairs and lifts. Repairs, and they have not been taken care of. So the government could have had a policy to, knowing that they're vulnerable, they have been made vulnerable, to actually prevent this happening rather than just intervening after it's all happened.
Yeah.
I think it's a perfect example of disaster capitalism, you know, seizing on an idea, using it to re-racialize that whole and homogenize that whole group of people.
So you were talking about how colonialism is being reflected in the way that this crisis is being approached. Looking at historical examples and how those have gone and how we look back on the mistreatment of Indigenous people around the world, why is it so difficult to learn from these mistakes, and why are we making them in such a publicly aware way, given the media attention that this public housing situation has had?
Yeah, look, that is perplexing, okay, because I think a lot of it relies on the ignorance that most of the people have been kept in. I think in Australia in particular, there has been we're not allowed to talk about race, and people have been deliberately miseducated, misinformed, and yet that covers some of the people that might be responding to this. But the people that do know better, I think it's just blatant. I think that it is not through ignorance, it's just wanting to keep power, really, and uphold white supremacy. It benefits a lot of people here. So the colonial situation, I mean, I think Aileen Morton Robinson, who's a fantastic and amazing scholar that I just adore in this country, Australia, the colonials didn't go home, so it's not post-colonial. Everything is based on white supremacy here. So it's different from the US, for example. I mean, it is similar to the US, but here it's still going on. There's been no treaty, there's been no reparations, there's been nothing like that. So I think the racial literacy of this country is extremely poor, which my wonderful colleague Alana Linton and Debbie Bargelli, who I'm working with at Griffith, the racial literacy that's needed to understand it is not available, and it's not taught, it's not practiced. So we need to understand what race is and how we recognize it. Otherwise, we'll keep on perpetuating. Meanwhile, those in power are going to keep using the playbook and the technology.
So then when we look at anti-racism and what we've been discussing today, I think that ultimately your point boils down to that these things are important, these people are valuable, and that we should normalize anti-racism as part of our self-interest. how can we make sure that we are making active steps towards that? What are the biggest issues that individuals need to tackle that can help reduce this issue?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that we're all coming from different levels of education and engagement with the issue. That's part of the issue. Trying to get a global or a whole movement going is difficult because we're all at different places. So I'd be saying, from where you stand, you know, how to go in and just actually think, what do I think about this? Read some more about it. Don't go and ask the first person of colour that you see, because go and read. There is multiple publications, amazing writing. Read more about it. Understand how this ignorance and delusion has been set up. And where am I in? How do I feel about it? Unpack those feelings. Unlearn what we've been told to learn and believe. Question the decisions that seem very normal to us, so we need to switch that around. You know, asking yourself questions. Why is it that certain suburbs, in this case, haven't been tested, haven't been locked down in that same way when, you know, but the racialized communities have? Do I understand race as a technology of power, or am I still thinking it's an individual attitude I'm holding, you know? Am I subscribing? Am I using the government or the, you know, the argument that, oh, this is done to protect us? So basically, it's about really questioning yourself, reading, educating yourself. And there is so much, there are so many resources around.
Fantastic. Well, Nilmini, thank you so much for joining us on Drive, and thank you for sticking around for a bit longer to talk with us here on the podcast, because your insight has been invaluable, and it's always so important to talk about and acknowledge these issues when they come up, because it can often feel like, you know, this is an issue of the past, but these examples clearly illustrate we are still tackling with it, and as you say, we still need to be focusing on how we can do that. So thank you again so much for your time.
And you're very welcome. Thank you.